going to jump out of order here a little bit, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 556A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 556A extends the period of time an employer may contest a citation and or propose civil penalty assessment and the period of time of correcting a violation of the Oregon Safe Employment Act and for an employee or their representative to contest the period of time to correct a violation from 20 to 30 days after receipt of the notice, citation, or order. It also extends the period of time from 10 to 20 days for recording a final judgment as a lien on a property if the penalty assessed for violating the Oregon Safe Employment Act has not been paid. And this measure passed unanimously out of both the Senate Commerce Committee and the Senate.
We have Senator Roger Beyer here today. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 556. You heard the bill described. That is what it does. It's simply a 10-day extension on issues dealing with OSHA violations, and it did pass the Senate Commerce Committee and the Senate unanimously. I don't know of any opposition to the bill, and I would just urge the committee to look upon it favorably and move it forward. And I thought Representative Gilliam was here to speak to it also, but I don't see him.
Well, we just went to get him. I think he's out in the hall.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Does anybody have any questions of Senator Beyer here today?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think Senator did a great job. Maybe we should hold him off. Okay. Might oversell it.
Okay. Well, we have the good representative, but he says he doesn't need to testify. So, no more. Are there any more questions of Senator Beyer? Okay, sir. Well,
thank you very much.
I have Lane Barlow and Michael Wood, please. Lane, if you're ready, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lane Barlow with the Russian American Builders Association. I have nothing to add to what Senator Beyer said. We endorse the bill as is with no changes and let her pass with a minimum of plus.
Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. We are comfortable with the bill as is. My written testimony does have some statistics regarding our appeals rate as well as a comparison with what some other states do. Beyond that, I'm simply open for any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? All right, very good. Thank you, gents. I'm going to close the work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 556A and open a work session on Senate Bill 556A. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 556A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 556A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse
me. Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this? Representative Escobar, thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 556A. I'm going to open public hearing on Senate Bill 746A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 746A establishes the maximum fee that the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board may charge an exempt operating cemetery for a certificate of authority to no more than $100 and the registration of principals to no more than $50. It also expands the number of small cemeteries that are eligible for a waiver of renewal and other fees from the board and prohibits the board from subjecting these types of cemeteries to random inspections. And under the measure, an exempt operating cemetery is one that has 10 or fewer interments annually.
And folks, I jumped out of order. I know the senator has work to do, and he's here on this bill. I'd like to hear from where he has to say, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. For you is Senate Bill 746, excuse me. And, again, your committee administrator has done a great job describing the bill. This bill is brought forward because of an issue in the last interim in my district specifically. It was brought to my attention by some very small cemeteries out there that were being forced to, I guess, for the first time ever, be inspected and pay some fees that when you're talking about a very few number of interments annually, it is very cost prohibitive for the people who eventually come pay those fees are the people who are being, the family members, the people who are being buried. So we just simply raised the number from 5 to 10 that kept it small operating, not subject to random inspections, and capped the fee that they could, the small exempt cemeteries could be charged for initial filing. With that, it's a good bill. I think there are probably other people here to testify two on the bill, and hopefully we addressed most of the concerns of the with the amendments in the original bill. I think the cemetery board may still be not completely happy with it, but the bill does not have much financial impact on them anymore, and so hopefully you would see fit to move the bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of the good senator? Representative Berger.
Yeah, I don't know whether the senator or the staff, but explain to me exactly, I think I get it, what an exempt cemetery is. Exempt from...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, under current law, exempt cemetery is a cemetery that has 5 interments or fewer in a calendar year. And that means that once they file a registration fee, there is also in addition to that, and Mr. Coe could probably speak to that and further if I get it wrong, but I keep pawing through the paper because I'm trying to find the Ann Gross bill and I don't seem to be able to find it. But the exempt cemetery is not subject to the annual fee of, I think it's $4 per interment.
Okay.
And and this raises that from five. Thank you. From 5 a year to 10 a year.
Got it.
And the other thing is, under current law, they are charging, I think it's $100 per cemetery and $50 per principal, but in practice they are saying that we only charge one principal, so this is just codifying the statute what the cemetery board is already doing in practice as far as capping the fee.
I had the privilege of going over this, the benefit of going over this with the senator in my office, and it seems to be all pretty straightforward to me. Any further questions of the senator? And we're all right. Well, if you do, you have time to stay and respond to any.
Mr. Chair, I will stay until the testimony is over.
Okay,
and,
thank you
I'll
very
just,
much.
For the record, what we have is that this will be about $4,000 a year of revenue that the cemetery board will not collect
right.
with under this bill that they would otherwise.
All right, thank you. I'm going to call David Koch, or Koch, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Koch. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. When this bill was introduced, the revenue impact was estimated to be about $47,000. It has now, as Senator Beyer indicated to you, that the lost revenue is more like $4,000 to $5,000. When it was $47,000, the board voted to oppose the bill, primarily because the board is in a significant revenue shortfall situation. Our next board meeting is not until the 22nd. I haven't gone back to the board to get their impression of how they feel about this bill now that the revenue impact has gone down from 47 to 4,000, but I think it's fair to say that they would be 90% less opposed to it than they were the last time, and I'm principally here to see if I can answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming today, sir. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 746A. I feel comfortable moving this forward. I'm going to open a work session with on Senate Bill 46A.
Want to go ahead?
Yes, please. We have four.
Oh, I didn't see Mr. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 746A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 746A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Oh.
I missed out on it, I guess. All right. See, is there any?
Sure, I would comment on this one, but I don't want to run it into the ground.
I'm just dying to say something about this bill.
In this particular case, not really. Right.
Representative Berger has moved this bill to the floor to pass. Is there any discussion? All right. Seeing none, Kristen, will you call the roll? Excuse.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
It's dead silence, but I will.
All right. Representative Berger, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 746A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 255A.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 255A clarifies that if a motor vehicle liability insurer does not request reimbursement for recovery of personal injury protection, otherwise known as PIP payments, from the other insurer, the insurer may recover payments only through the lien process or subrogation. It also ensures that any costs or attorney fees the injured claimant incurs in connection with recovery are shared by the insurer who gets reimbursed. And the measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development Committee, as well as the Senate.
Thank you. I have Neil Jackson and Steve Worrell. Please. Whenever you're ready there, Steve, go ahead. Hey, man, I'm just working here.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance Companies. The bill you have in front of you, I think, is basically a clarifying existing law. Personal injury protection coverage is a coverage that is mandated in Oregon on every automobile. What it provides for is to pay some medical expenses. If you're employed, it pays lost wages. If you're not employed, it will pay for essential services that you would have done for your family that you can't do because you're hurt. And finally, if you were to die in an accident, it provides a funeral benefit. An insurer who pays personal injury protection benefits is allowed to recover the money from the at-fault party, the money they pay out. There are three methods that the statute provides for that. The statute being amended in front of you is 742.534, which is direct reimbursement between insurance companies. You go insurance company to insurance company, and we arbitrate disputes between the insurance companies to get the money back. If for some reason you choose not to use that method, there are two other methods in the statute, 536, which is the assertion of a lien over a suit that your insured files, and then 538 is the catch-all method, which allows you to recover your money in some way, some fashion, if you don't use one of the other two methods or one of the other two methods is not available to you. Under 742, 536, and 538, I think it's pretty clear that when the attorney makes a recovery, for your insurer that you share the attorney's fee out of your PIP subrogation. What this bill does is two things. It says if you don't use the direct insurer to insurer reimbursement, then you can only use the other two methods that I just explained to you. And then when you use the other two methods, if an attorney is involved, you share the attorney fees with him. There were some insurers, apparently I don't know who they were, but we're saying there were other portions of the PIP statute that seemed to indicate they got their money back always without sharing an attorney fee. I think that interpretation was out of context in the statute. I think there's probably a Court of Appeals case called Gaussin, G-A-U-C-I-N, that clarified that that's not the case, but what we're doing here today is we're codifying it so that this will now be how it happens, the way that I think most people understood how the statute works.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Travelers Association. Mr. Mueller's done a good job of explaining what the bill does. There is one company that would literally refuse to choose the manner they wish to be reimbursed, and therefore the attorney for the injured party has to include those PIP payments in any claim or any suit that the attorney filed on behalf of the injured person. Then the company would let them go ahead and finish the suit, recover the money, and then they would come forward and say, give us all of it, we're not paying you anything for getting it for us. And as Mr. Mueller said, this simply makes it clear that if they don't elect the 534 method, which is the direct between the companies, they have to go under 536 or 538, and they are those two statutes are very clear as to the sharing of the costs and attorney's fees that has to happen. And our position is basically this bill clears up any question about whether or not they have to elect as is required in 742-536-02. And that's all it does.
Any questions? I guess you guys did a good job of explaining it. Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 255A today? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 255A, and I'm going to work the work session on Senate Bill 255A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 255A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves Senate Bill 255A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please. Excuse me.
Aye.
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 Excuse
me. Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill? Representative Holby, thank you very much. going to close the work session on Senate Bill 255A, and I'm opening a work session on, a public hearing on Senate Bill 603.
Please tell me if they're laughing because I'm carrying the burden.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 603 changes the current statutory requirement that one-third of a domestic insurer's board of directors be Oregon residents to requiring that only one-quarter of the board's directors be residents of the state. And the bill declares an emergency effective on passage and also passed unanimously out of the Senate Business Transportation and Workforce Development Committee and also the Senate.
Thank you. And we have Justin Delaney and John Powell here to help us understand what we're doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Standard Insurance Company. With me is Justin Delaney, among other duties, with the company's assistant general counsel. Mr. Delaney will explain this bill. It's very simple and very forthright with a dilemma that their company faces in the face of national and even international competition in this era.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Delaney. Senate Bill 603 is something that's very important to Standard. We've grown a lot in our 101 years in business. Today we insure and provide financial services to over 8 million Americans, and we have over 2,200 employees in Oregon. We are an Oregon success. We've grown so big, though, that we're bumping into the bigger players from the East Coast. I don't need to tell you their names, but they're 10, 20, and 30 times bigger than we are. To compete with those companies, we have to really focus. And one way we focus is hiring executives and directors with specialized expertise. Our board presently is recruiting a board member, and we look for executive-level expertise in corporate finance, marketing, things that aren't in abundant supply in Oregon. Another area that concerns us as a company is a diverse representation on our board. And again, looking at the CEO and executive level, it's a hard thing to find sometimes in Oregon. There's no opposition to this bill. The insurance division is neutral. We met with them before we introduced it. Ask that you pass this bill. Thank you.
And I think a lot of those insurance companies are in Iowa, aren't they?
Iowa, Connecticut.
Yeah, well, we got to keep up with the Iowans, don't we? thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, if you look at the bold print in the bill and the dilemma that Standard faces right now is there in the current law, there is a threshold of for the number of board members that must be on a domestic insurance company's board. And right now, you have to have not fewer than five directors, and one-third of the directors must reside in this state. What this bill does is it changes that to 25%. And the reasons Mr. Delaney articulated, if you have expertise in marketing that's being very helpful on your board, and you have a board member quit or get to an age where they must retire, you get stuck in these dilemmas when you have another candidate that could be best suited for this job but not necessarily reside in Oregon. And as he pointed out, our competitors don't have this kind of limitation. So when you're looking for diversity at this level, in terms of all of the areas of diversity, and somebody who has this kind of expertise and experience, it's difficult to fill this. And as he pointed out, there's no opposition to the bill, and it'd be very helpful to this Oregon corporation.
Thank you. Any questions? Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 835? All right.
Okay. 603.
603. 835 is next. Excuse me. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe this is a conflict of interest, but I have to mention that I believe that years and years ago, my grandfather was on the board of Standard Insurance.
In your defense, I will say that half of the legislature in Oregon has some prior connection
with
Standard Insurance Standard Company.
It's long gone, so I don't think there's a conflict.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 603? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 603. Open work session on Senate Bill 603. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 603 to the House floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 603 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, Kristen, please. Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Smith.
Aye. I think I'll volunteer to carry that bill, and I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 603, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 835. Teresa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 835 requires the Management Labor Advisory Committee, otherwise known as PEMLAC, to study the adequacy of workers' compensation death benefits. It also instructs the committee to report its findings to the Legislative Assembly by January 31st, 2009. The measure does have the MLAC support and unanimously passed out of the Senate Commerce Committee and out of the Senate with a 22-4 vote.
We have the very busy Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. At least I remembered to do that this time. I appreciate you hearing this bill. This came to me from, while they are not actually my constituents, she teaches in a school in my district. They are actually Senator Prozonsky's constituents, but Cammie and Greg Wilberger, they live in Veneta. Their daughter, Brooke, was kidnapped and murdered while she was on the job. She was kidnapped in 2004. She was on summer break after completing her freshman year at BYU, and there was a great deal of community support in trying to locate Brooke. And, in fact, her body has never been located, so technically they haven't been able to have a burial. But her her alleged perpetrator has been indicted for a murder and other crimes in another state and has not yet been extradited to Oregon because those other crimes are still pending. But the reason I came to you is because they made a claim for workers' comp death benefits for their daughter when she turned up missing, and the problems they were encountered were a number that they should not have been encountered. And this is an issue that has plagued the legislature for a number of years. First off, they didn't make a claim until she had been determined to be murdered. So when they filed the claim, the workers' comp agency, and I won't tell you which one it is because it's not important, they denied the claim on the basis that the claim was filed late. Well, the claim was filed late because their child was still missing and had not yet been declared to be murdered. So then they denied the claim on the basis that she was a single person and not a dependent. Which I would argue, and any of you who have children that are my children's age, mine are 27 and soon to be 29, and they're in graduate school now, but a 19-year-old is still generally a dependent of the parent while you're going to college. So the workers' comp agency, the carrier, decided to finally settle with the Wilbergers, and they paid their attorney's fees for bringing the action, and then they paid a burial benefit. But there has been no burial, so basically all the Wilbergers got out of this was their attorney fees paid. And attention brought to this issue about death benefits. The death benefits are based on the average weekly wage earned in Oregon, and then it's, in addition to that, it's like 10 times the average weekly wage. So when people gave up the right to sue under workers' comp, they were stuck with these little determinations that are set out in statute in terms of how much you can be paid. It's a paltry sum for some people. There is a gentleman who communicated with me when I was doing all my workers' comp stuff a couple of years ago, and his daughter was killed on the job. And the company was fined by OSHA, and they received $5,000. And he's pretty upset that his daughter's life was worth only $5,000, particularly when the employer was at fault in her death. So this bill would require MLAC to study the death benefit statutes, to look at who should be receiving those benefits, the current method for calculating them, the categories, of course, of benefits of the beneficiaries, and whether you should be provided a lump sum, sort of like an insurance policy, or some other sum. And MLAC has agreed that it's
probably time and long overdue for them to do that, and this just directs them to do that. And that was the most simple way I could address this very tragic problem and a very earnest problem that I think the legislature needs to review.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Senator, for bringing this forth. I think it's a very, very good bill, and it needs to be completed. What's interesting, when you mentioned about a young person being a dependent while going to college, they're saying it wasn't a dependent, yet on the other hand, if that child wanted financial aid, they're automatically, even if they don't live with the parents, hooked to their income. So I think that's pretty much bureaucracy at its best.
Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel, I couldn't agree with you more. I thought that was the most, if you pardon my French, asinine argument I had ever heard. And you are exactly right. My children went through the same thing when they were going to college. Their financial aid is based on their income and their parents' income, unless you are an emancipated minor. And I guarantee you that Ms. Brooke Wilberger was not an emancipated minor because she had a very loving family. They're a Mormon family, very close. That's why she was at BYU. She had a tremendous life ahead of her, and someone decided that they were going to take her life for whatever reason, and I think that's inappropriate, and the Wilbergers have come to terms with that. But, you know, they've not come to terms with the fact that they didn't feel that they were treated properly in this process. And so I'm just trying to see if we can do right by them and others.
Thank you. Any further questions?
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Walker, clearly this doesn't predetermine any particular outcome to this, so they'll look at this. It might be that legislative changes would be recommended as a result, but you haven't really dictated what the outcome will be.
No, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rosenbaum, it's interesting because I was reviewing my notes from the hearing in the Senate on 416, and Senator Beyer asked the same exact question.
And I very often think alike.
So. Yeah, coming from different angles, I think, but
okay.
You're exactly right. And, you know, part of the problem is, and if I can just digress a bit, I really don't like the MLAC system. I think it's faulty. I know there's been efforts to change it. I've made efforts to change it. I wanted to change the whole structure of MLAC and put different sorts of people on it instead of management and labor, because the MLAC to me feels like a mini legislature, and it's very, very difficult to get anything passed in this legislature regarding workers' comp without MLAC's approval. I've tried it, I know, because if you can even get it passed the legislature, the governor usually vetoes it because he values the MLAC process. And I do in a sense, but I also believe that it's awfully rigid, and I would like to see some changes made. So I can't make this change legislatively without involving MLAC in their hearing process. And the testimony at the hearing was that they'll appoint a subcommittee and work on this issue. And I do believe that they're very interested in pursuing the matter, because this is a tragic case, as all of the fatalities generally are. But this one was a little bit different. They need to take a look.
Senator, I do support the MLAC process. That's probably no secret to anyone around here. And I think we have a board of people that are experts in their field and are steeped in workers' comp. And I think the process has, you know, stabilized workers' comp insurance, at the same time provided benefits to injured workers. But that's a big, huge help in our economy. That being said, I definitely agree. They do need to take a look at the death benefit. I have no problem with this at all. But are there any other questions, the good senator here today? And you're right, it can seem inflexible and rigid at times.
Mr. Chair, and the changes I wanted to make, I looked at other states. I think Wisconsin was the first one to have an MLAC sort of committee. And they have lawyers on it. They have insurance people on it. They have people from academia. I mean, it's a lot more diverse than management and labor. And that's what I was looking for, a little bit more perspective and diversity. But I'm never going to get there. So I tried to run at it again this session, and I think I'm going to hang up my spurs on that one. I just can't get it there. So we'll let it go.
Anything else for the good senator? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Jerry Manigan and Bill Kludig, please. Whoever sits down first gets to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Manahan. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer Business Services. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 835. Under the workers' compensation law, there is a death benefit for the dependents and survivors of people who are killed on the job. The fatal benefits are also provided for people who are determined to be permanently totally disabled. When they die, that benefit converts to a fatal benefit. And then each year, those benefits to those dependents of the injured worker, they get a cost of living increase, which comes out of the workers' benefit fund. And basically, the dependent status under the current law is typically it's going to be a spouse, dependent children, and any other people who are dependent upon the worker at the time of the death. One other thing that provides is a death burial benefit, which is 10 times the state's average weekly wage. Senate Bill 835, as Senator Walker said, it has MLAC study these benefit levels during the interim period to look at the method of how these benefits are calculated, the burial amounts, the categories of beneficiaries who would be entitled to benefit, and the feasibility of providing the lump sum benefits. After the study, MLAC, with this bill, is required to report back to the 75th Legislative Assembly. We really think the study is important. We think it's really timely. About 10 years ago, there were some changes to the death benefit levels through the legislature. But so it's been over 10 years since it's really been looked at. The other thing is there's been other issues come up, as Senator Walker alluded to. This session, Representative Cannon in HB 2706 had a similar type of issue regarding the benefits for the surviving parent. And we've talked with Representative Cannon, and he also believes that his issues could be incorporated in this study. MLAC has seen this, and they do support this. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Bill, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Schaffner, Committee. For the record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Our carpenters are in favor of this 835. I'll just use the same testimony I used on the Senate side. I just received the copy of the biannual report from Workman's Comp. It's pretty thick, and I spent the whole weekend reading through it. I did find where the employers of Oregon are in the top 10 of the nation for paying the least amount for Workman's Comp. Now, that's a good thing, up to a point. But I could not find in there where Oregon placed in the top 50 in the 50 states were for the death benefit of a person killed on the job. I'll say it here, and as I said in the Senate, I feel that a person that gets killed on the job in this state should be at least in the top 10 in the nation for benefits for the family. I worked in the industry where accidents happen. We averaged one every 10 years in my 40 years in that one plant. It happens. It shouldn't, but it does. But I feel that the state needs to take a long look to see if we can't help these families out when that worker does not come home. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? I guess I would just say we have to be, this is a real, when you're talking about the death family member, it's very, very delicate. If I lost a family member, that being said, all the money in the world ain't going to bring that family member back. Now, as far as the dependents that that worker, that rely on that worker's income, that would be the focus here if I were doing the study. Helping dependents, children, for example, of a deceased worker. But we're not going to be able to buy the person's life back. And it's very emotional. I just hope they stay focused on what we're trying to do here. And I'm confident you will. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you, gentlemen. Anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 835? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 835 and open work session on Senate Bill 835. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 835 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 835 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Excused. Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Esquivel, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Senate Bill 835. And anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned.